From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. After a long presidential campaign where so-called social values issues took a backseat to the economy, the post-election politics of gay marriage are heated. On Election Day, California voters passed Proposition 8, which banned gay marriages. Unlike other states with ballot initiatives, gays and lesbians actually could marry by law in California until the initiative passed. Black voters make up only 10% of the electorate, but were also the most likely to vote for the ban. Now some organizers blame black Californians for denying them the right to marry. This isn't just a California issue either. Protests have stretched from coast to coast with more planned for this weekend. At one Los Angeles march, a man lifted a sign saying, "Gay is the new black," a reference to voters who feel that while election 2008 was a victory for race relations, it set back gay rights. Today we're going to look at this issue specifically, but also the ramifications it has for American politics at large. First, we'll take a look at the issue from a neighborhood level. Gary Gates is a demographer from the Charles R. Williams Institute on Sexual Orientation Law and Public Policy at the University of California, Los Angeles. Gary, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
So we've heard reports that there's a lot of tension on the streets. Some gays and lesbians of color are caught in the verbal crossfire. We want to play you just a little bit of a conversation we had with our blogger, Jasmine Kanick.
There was a protest last night in Westwood wherein upon several black people were accosted and called the N-word. Some of those black people happened to have been gay, and they were being called those names by white gay folks who said it was you people who took away our rights. They didn't know that they were gay. All they saw were black people.
Does this hold up to what you've been hearing about some of the tensions on the streets?
Well, I mean, I think clearly this has raised tensions. But what I think from my work is one of the things that I find in studying kind of the geographic and demographic patterns of the gay community in Los Angeles is that the distinctions that you see in the broader population are true in the gay population. You know, so here, you know, we have West Hollywood is seen as a gay center, a center of gay life in Los Angeles. That's primarily a white gay male enclave. And black gay people and Latino and Latino and Asian Pacific, they don't necessarily live there. They live in Black gay people live in South L.A. and Latino and Latina gay people live in East L.A. So
that's something that someone who came on our show earlier to filmmaker mentioned, that he felt that basically what we call gay neighborhoods in America are places where people have come mainly from white communities, you know, in other cities or other places, and that African-American gays and lesbians tend to stay in the communities where they were born and raised. Do you find that there's any truth to that kind of assessment?
There's definitely truth that what we know of as gay neighborhoods, so, you know, the big ones would be like the Castro or West Hollywood or the New York neighborhoods, whether it was the Village or Chelsea, or it sort of keeps moving. But those neighborhoods are primarily white and male. And there's multiple reasons for that, one of which I think is that in order to create neighborhoods, you have to be a mobile population. And to be mobile, you probably have to have a certain level of economic advantage. And that's white men. And gay or not, that's white men in our society.
You know, tell me a little bit more from your research about socioeconomic differences. Is it pretty much the same socioeconomic difference that you see between, say, gay white man and gay black man that you would between a straight white man and a straight black man?
Broadly, yes. I mean, what we see in the gay community is that people of color seem to have the same kinds of disadvantages that in the gay community that they do in the broader community. And now that said, one interesting group whether it's African-American or white, that seems to have a disadvantage in the gay community are people raising kids. All of those people seem to have lower economic status than their married counterparts if they're in a couple. But that said, if it's a black or Hispanic person, and by the way, those groups are 2 to 3 times more likely within the gay community to be raising children. So the image, the Will and Grace image of the white New York gay male couple raising kids is a real minority in the community. The real image of gay people raising kids are people of color. And they are substantially economically distressed relative both to their white counterparts and to the population in general.
Well, I want to bring a couple more folks into the conversation. We've got Patrick Salmon, national president of the Log Cabin Republicans, a group that supports gay rights, and Ron Buckmeyer, board president of the Barbara Jordan Bayard Rustin Coalition. It's a black gay rights group in Los Angeles. Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good to be with you.
Nice to be with you, Fry.
So, Ron, I'm going to start with you. What's your assessment of how this issue has played out so far in terms of, you know, bringing together the issues of race and sexual orientation, but also just the anger that's expressed?
Well, it's been a hurricane, basically, since Proposition 8 passed. Well, since Proposition 8 passed and the exit poll was released showing – the CNN exit poll was released showing that 70% of African Americans voted for Proposition 8. There are still some questions about whether how accurate that poll is. Because in that poll, it also says that the African American electorate is 10%, which is a very iffy number. African Americans make up 6% of the population in California. But regardless, it is pretty clear that African Americans voted for Proposition 8, voted to eliminate the fundamental right to marry for same-sex couples at a much higher rate than any other ethnic group in California. And that's very, very distressing, especially to people like me who are in both groups, are black and are gay.
Why do you think that black voters were the most likely to vote for Prop 8?
I think it's complicated. I think it shows that there is a lot of work that the gay groups need to do, and also, frankly, the gay black groups need to do to reach out to the African-American population to make them realize that Proposition 8 was not about religion. It was about a civil marriage ceremony. It was about a fundamental right. And passing Proposition 8 was an incredibly horrible precedent. People of California said they were going to just reach out and rip out a right that had been granted by the Supreme Court of California, and then 173 days later, basically divorce me and, you know, 18,000 other couples like myself who had gotten married in the interregnum.
When you think about this issue, Patrick, your group, Log Cabin Republicans, has been a group that obviously, you're Republicans, but you've also had some differences with, for example, the party platform. How did you come down on Prop 8, and then what did you do as a group in addressing it?
Well, we were one of the first national gay rights organizations to support marriage equality back in the early 90s. And so we were obviously very much against Proposition 8, and we were proud that Governor Schwarzenegger at our national convention in April came out against any constitutional amendment to roll back marriage. We actually had a campaign, Republicans Against 8, which complemented the broader No on 8 campaign, where we were working to get Republicans opposing Prop 8. You know, the thing that's so unfortunate to me about what's happened here is it shouldn't be blaming anyone. I would hope that what our community goes through is figuring out why we lost and changing our strategy next time to make sure it doesn't happen. So it really is awful that any group is being blamed. I mean, 84% of Republicans voted yes. They should be blamed. You know, a couple numbers that stuck out in my mind was 38% of the yes votes were Barack Obama supporters. And so that just shows us that we need to make progress with Democrats and independents and Republicans. And then another group, 84% of weekly churchgoers voted yes on Prop 8. So rather than pointing fingers at anyone, I think we just need to look at the numbers and understand where and how we need to do better in the future, both in California and other states.
What do you think is the next step for a group like yours who, you know, you can sit down with the governor, you can have a conversation, and Governor Schwarzenegger himself has changed over time on how he addressed the issue. But we're going to talk more about what the future strategies are, but where are you going from here specifically?
Well, at the end of the day, equality is impossible to achieve without Republican votes. And unfortunately, the outcome here in California showed that. So we're committed to continuing to work with inside the Republican Republican Party to make it better. Even with bigger Democratic majorities in Congress, they're going to need Republican votes to pass a lot of that legislation, particularly in the Senate, where you need a filibuster-proof majority. So we're committed to doing the difficult work. We know we're making progress with rank-and-file Republicans. On an issue like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, way back in 1993, only 32% of Republicans favored allowing gays and lesbians to serve in the military. Now that number's up to 64%. So there's no question we're making progress, but the results here in California certainly show how much work still needs to be done.
Ron, we're going to go to a break shortly, but just before we do, just quickly, and I'll use this as a teaser. Do you think black people are more homophobic than white people? An issue that's come up many times.
I think no, I do not think that. And I think the great response to that is I think of my friend Keith Boykin, who wrote a famous blog post entitled, "Why Are White People So Homophobic?" And he talks about there's so many examples. For example, at the time it was the head of the military, Peter Pace, talking about how he didn't accept gays in the military, that it was just wrong. It was his moral religious views. There's so many more examples of white people saying homophobic things than there are black people saying homophobic things. It's just fascinating to me that people sort of get caught up in this strange meme that, quote unquote, black people are more homophobic, when really homophobia happens in all communities.
All right. Well, that's a great place to leave us before the break. We want all of you to stick with us. We're talking about Proposition 8 and how it's had a ripple effect on the conversation about race, sexual orientation, and equality. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're taking a look at the battles over race and gay rights launched by California's Proposition 8. With us, Gary Gates, a demographer at the University of California, Los Angeles, Patrick Salmon, national president of the Log Cabin Republicans, and Ron Buckmeyer, board president of the Barbara Jordan Bayard Rustin Coalition. So welcome back, guys. And, you know, I'm wondering, Gary, you mentioned specifically gay male neighborhoods, mainly white. Do you know anything about where lesbians tend to live? Are there lesbian neighborhoods?
There are, but they generally are this is oversimplified, but the pattern tends to be that they're around white gay male neighborhoods. So a little further out, probably a little more kid friendly, a little less expensive neighborhoods than where the gay men live.
And is it also a situation where those neighborhoods tend to be more racially?
They do tend to be a little more racially and ethnically mixed, in part because they are less expensive neighborhoods than the gay male neighborhoods. So, and there's much higher rates of child rearing, obviously, among lesbians and lesbian couples. And so, again, those neighborhoods are seen as more affordable.
Ron, when you think about what we're talking about, and we on News and Notes have tried many times to have conversations about the intersection of race and other forms of identity. Is this a case, as some people argue, where one identity was prioritized over another? For example, not just race, but identity as a churchgoer. You know, if your identity as a churchgoer was prioritized over, you know, other identities that you have of being someone who, you know, sees gay and lesbian members of your family and who wants certain things for them. I mean, how do people in your experience that you've met prioritize what they believe in when it comes to a situation like this that is a social values issue?
Well, that's what I mean by more education needs to happen. It's true. I simply can't understand it myself. I've spoken with people who are, you know, college professors and are religious, and they know that we're talking about civil marriage. It has nothing to do with going to a church, but yet they say, you know, my pastor says I have to vote yes on Proposition 8, and that's what they do. I mean, so clearly they are prioritizing one particular identity over another. But another part of your question, which sort of raises my hackles, is this question about, well, which are you first? Are you black? Are you gay? Are you gay? Are you black? And it sort of – it denies the idea that one can be both simultaneously. It's like asking Barack Obama, which is he, black or white? White or black? He is both.
Patrick, what's – when you think about – the response to this? There have been protests all over the country, some of them tense, some of them very specific, like this person gave this money to this part of the Yes on 8 coalition. We're going to protest in front of this business. Some of them much more general. One of the things that came up over the course of the past 8 years was with anti-war protests, is protest still an effective form of civil interaction? From your perspective as someone who watches politics, do you think these protests are accomplishing what they set out to do?
Well, as a Republican, I'm more conservative, so protests are never high on my list. But I have to say, for myself even, my reaction to this passage of Prop 8 has been anger. And so I can understand why people want to do something to show their anger. I think our challenge going forward as a movement working toward equality for all is how we, within the next few weeks, transfer that anger into positive momentum to move forward. Because at the end of the day, anger won't get us any closer to achieving where we want to go. So what we need to do is, again, figure out why we lost and get more people involved. I wish there would have been people marching before the vote. I wish there would have been more people working phone banks and knocking on doors. And I know a lot of people did all that they could to try and defeat 8, but it's a bit frustrating in my mind that there wasn't this activism before the vote. So what we have to do is make use of the energy and the anger and move forward in a positive way rather than just throwing rocks.
But I will add just briefly that as a sort of stats person, from 2000 to 2008, the percentage who voted against same-sex marriage has gone from 62% to 52%. That's enormous for any social issue to change that much in that short of a time. So I think there is a little bit of perspective here to say that there is enormous change going on already.
I'm going to give you the last word, Ron. I'm going to have to make it short. But if you had to say to someone who just absolutely says, look, my pastor, and this is something many people have said, my pastor told me to vote yes, and I did. What's your shorthand answer on that one?
Well, if it's a black person, I would say there are black LGBT people like me. When you are voting to eliminate my right to marry, you are hurting members of the black community. You are hurting your own community by doing that. Black LGBT people need access to all the rights and responsibilities of marriage, just like everyone else. And so please don't do that.
Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. We were speaking with Ron Buckmeyer, board president of the Barbara Jordan Bayard Rustin Coalition. That's a black gay rights group in Los Angeles. Also with Patrick Salmon, national president of the Log Cabin Republicans. Gary Gates, a demographer from the Charles R. Williams Institute on Sexual Orientation Law at Public Policy. They all joined us here at NPR West. And if you want to see video of our conversation, please check it out at our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. In the media game right now, the score is economy 1, newsroom staff 0. Layoffs and cutbacks have hit the media big time, and yet we have a new administration coming in, and yes, as we will be repeating over and over, it's got America's first black president. So are the same news organizations being buffeted by economic change also making sure their political reporting staff is diverse? Will the press corps' diversity affect coverage of the administration? The New York Times added Liberian-born reporter Helene Cooper to their White House team, and the Washington Post has Michael Fletcher. We've got Michael Fletcher with us now, along with Richard Prince of the Maynard Institute. He writes a column about diversity issues in the news business called Journalisms. Guys, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here.
So, Michael, you are among the best of the best of the best, and of course also the onlyest of the onlyest of the onlyest. What's it like being a member of the White House press corps?
It's an interesting life. I did it for 3 years under President Bush, and it's kind of a unique kind of journalism you perform in the White House press corps. You're kind of bubbled up, as we say, most of the time. you know, when you cover most beats, you kind of have to run at a place. If you cover Congress, you move around the Capitol a lot and do the various House offices. But at the White House, you're kind of penned up in that White House briefing room, and you spend a lot of time trying to email and call White House aides to try to find out what's going on, and that's a pretty arduous task. So it's kind of a bubbled up world, and obviously you travel with the president, you know, almost all over the globe, and so you're kind of part of this traveling show, if you will. So it's an interesting life, but a pretty unique one journalistically, and it kind of in some ways can be limiting journalistically too if you're not careful.
I got to go on Air Force One a couple times as part of the press pool, which is not the same as the press corps. You kind of rotate on, but the question is more for the people who are part of the press corps, is there a lot of color in the room? Is there a lot of diversity? And does it make a difference? I mean, I know that you have a perspective from being in that position, but do you think, as much as you can tell us, that it makes a difference whether or not you have people of color who are part of the White House press corps?
Yeah, I certainly think it makes a difference, and it makes a difference not only under a black president either. You know, I was struck by how few African Americans and really other minorities were in the press corps when I did it under Bush. And really, I mean, that's actually a charge you can probably apply to the business generally. It seems like diversity is slipping. I don't know the latest numbers, but it just doesn't feel like it's expanding despite all the talk about it. And I think it matters when it comes down to stories, kind of our filters, not that every black or minority reporter will filter stories the same way, but I think we have different sensibilities and so on that would elevate some things into the level of, you know, being a story while maybe, you know, pushing other things aside. I think we'd bring different context to stories. So I think it's important to have diversity, not just racially, but, you know, gender and sort of the whole panoply of the kinds of diversities you can think of. I think it really does impact coverage.
Richard, when you look at the big picture, because you study, you know, who's doing what where, who's firing who where, what are you seeing right now, both overall for newsroom diversity and then also as it applies to political journalists?
Well, I see a lot of disappointment in terms of diversity, in terms of political coverage. We just had this campaign with, as you pointed out, the first African-American family about to enter the White House. A lot of people would have thought that on the campaign trail we would have had a lot more African-Americans and other people of color there. But as Michael and others can tell you, on that campaign plane, often there were maybe one or two, people of color on the plane. Even last week at the president-elect's first news conference, there were no journalists of color who were called on to ask any questions. And the background of all this, as you pointed out, is that the newsrooms are undergoing this great contraction because of the contraction in the economy and also because of the migration of advertising dollars to the internet. Meanwhile, the demographics of the country are changing. And, you know, people of color are going to be the majority in a few decades. And it's even more important to have diversity of coverage and diversity on staff. So there's kind of a disconnect there.
What is the importance of lived experience? And this could cut either way. I'm thinking about the moments during the riots after Reverend King's death, when a lot of people who were black and in the newsroom but who were not reporters, who were, you know, copy clerks and things like that, were sent out to cover the news. And folks found out, wow, surprise, these guys actually can be reporters. And they weren't necessarily formally trained in any way, but they also hadn't been given the opportunity. But when the fire got hot, literally, black folks were sent out to cover what was going on in black communities. At the same time, you want to think as a reporter that you can learn so that you don't have to be of one race to be able to cover a certain topic. How do you make sense of the question of lived experience as well as learned experience when you go out on the road, Michael?
That's an interesting question. One thing I do know is you talk about kind of that first generation of sort of the big wave of African-American reporters coming in. I look back, it's interesting, striking to look back at newspaper coverage, you know, from 30 or 40 years ago, particularly when the black community is being written about, and just the distance that you can sense in the stories. Like, you know, we're writing, it's almost like, you know, we're venturing to a foreign land to write about these people. And I think there's sort of that lived experience that closes that gap. It, you know, we write with a more, you know, with more familiarity. We write like, you know, this is part of our society, you know. So I think it just sets a different tone for the coverage.
So let me just add to this. When you have a black family, and as Richard pointed out, it really will be a family and not just one person in the White House, is there a value to having at least some people who have lived experience of being black?
Yeah, I would like to think so. I think, of course. I mean, I think there's just so many things you kind of get instantly that, you know, that wouldn't be maybe obvious to someone who doesn't have that same, as you put it, lived experience. So I think it's important. Again, it's not to say that if Richard and I are covering the White House, we're going to write the exact same stories, or our stories will, you know, always agree. But at the same time, I think there's a certain kind of, again, sort of cultural kind of understanding that you know, you sort of have just intuitively.
Richard, what's the path ahead for news organizations dealing with their needs to cover a time of immense change in America, including changes in how we perceive race and leadership? And, you know, there, when you as a company leader face a situation like this where there's massive layoffs and news organizations shutting down, why would you want to prioritize diversity? Why is it important?
Because your audience is becoming more diverse, and you want to be able to relate to those members of your audience, of your readership or your listenership. Indian Americans, for example, are voracious newspaper readers. And so it would make sense if you're a newspaper and you've got an Indian American community to try to cater to that audience so they'll keep buying your paper. We saw the evidence of the hunger of African Americans for great news about the progress of black people in this country last week when all the newspapers were snapped up announcing Barack Obama's election, and 65% or so of those people were African Americans themselves who wanted to make sure to preserve that bit of history for their children and grandchildren. So the future of the business is in catering to the changing demographics in your own market. And there's, even though there's been a contraction in the general interest newspapers, we find that ethnic newspapers and broadcast outlets such as, Hispanic publications and weekly newspapers that cater to certain ethnic groups are actually growing.
All right. I'm going to give you the final word, Michael, and just quickly, what's the number one thing you're looking forward to being in the press corps this time around?
Well, just sort of witnessing this kind of history unfold in front of me. I think that's the thing that draws me to the story the most, the idea of this being the first African-American president. Now, obviously, he's facing huge challenges, but I think something about the historic nature of his presidency is, that's the number one thing for me.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
We were speaking with Michael Fletcher, a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. He covered the current Bush presidency from 2005 through 2007. Richard Prince writes a column about diversity issues in the news business. It's called Journalisms, and he writes it for the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education. And he joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's Thursday, and that means time for sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai, here is a question for you. Which job is easier for a black man in America to get, president of the United States or head coach of a Division I college football program?
Well, I didn't see a place to vote for the coaches on my ballot.
Pretty good. Maybe it's not really a fair comparison, but a recent study suggests that getting to the White House just might be a little easier. But I'm not the expert here, so let's bring in our resident sports specialist, Bill Roden, sports columnist with the New York Times. Hey, Bill.
Hey, the great Tony Cox. How you doing?
I'm doing great. We have a lot to talk about, but let's deal with this one first, because the annual report by the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport at the University of Central Florida was recently released, and here's what it said, basically. There are 119 schools in Division 1A of the NCAA. Those are the bigger school programs. There are only
4 black head football coaches out of those 119 campuses, the lowest number in 15 years. It's not surprising, is it? Or is it?
You know, Tony, it's stunning. I mean, your question to Farai is just wonderful. I mean, it's easier to become the president of the United States than to coach at the University of Alabama for an African American. And what makes it so phenomenal, Tony, is that if you look at the SEC, the Big Ten, the Pac-10, those teams are like 60-65% African American when you look at the starting lineups. So there is this, over the period of 10 years, there's been this phenomenal pool of people who have come through the system to be head coaches. I mean, it's mind-boggling, and I think that for all the elation that we've got for the presidential race, I think when you begin looking at areas below that, like in sports, I think you see that there's really, really a long way to go.
Well, you know, the NFL has the Rooney Rule, which requires NFL clubs to at least interview black and minority mm-hmm. candidates for head coaching vacancies. And by the way, the percentage of black head coaches is much higher in the NFL than it is in the college ranks. But still, Bill, could you ever envision a Rooney Rule for college football coaching jobs?
Yeah, you know, I've advocated that, and I'm going to keep pushing for it. You know, Miles Brand, the president of the NCAA says, well, you really can't do it because these are colleges and it's a little different. And there's no excuse for it, Tony, and there should be. I don't know if we call it the Rooney Rule, but we have to really begin to lean on the presidents of these universities because the athletic directors are making these calls, and it's really the quintessential old boys network, and where you're basically telling the black kids there and their parents, you know, listen, you guys just kind of tote that barge, lift that bale, and we'll be the head coaches and ADs. And I think it's really going to be up to the parents, Tony. It's going to be up to the parents to really monitor where they send their kids to school.
All right, let's switch to the NFL, where complaints about inequity have taken a decidedly different turn for pro football players, at least some former pro football players, who sued the Players Association and won. What happened?
Well, what happened is that you have a class action suit from a lot of retired players suing Players, Inc., which is a marketing arm of the Players Association, and basically saying that Players, Inc. has systematically cheated a number of retired players from receiving the royalties that were due them in a very conscious and concerted way. And some of the testimony was really startling. I mean, the Players Union, which was headed by the late Gene Upshaw, was basically telling EA Sports, which does, you know, the Madden 2000 game, mm-hmm. to sort of distort the images so you couldn't really see who some of these players were. You know, they've got these games from the old Green Bay Packers, all these old teams, and they were saying, well, distort the images so you really couldn't see who these old players were so we don't have to pay them royalties. And what's phenomenal is that all the stuff was on emails, you know. And so they won a huge award. They won like $28 million. But I just think it just shows the divide that the NFLPA created between the old and new players. And it's phenomenal. Hopefully, with the election of a new executive director in March, this divide between young and old players will end.
We're talking about dividing. Let's move on to the NBA and talk about how a team is trying to cross that divide. It's something you don't hear very often in sports. The NBA's New Jersey Nets are giving away 1,500 tickets to their home games for the rest of the year. But to get one of those tickets, listen to this now, you have to be unemployed. How about that? The Nets are asking fans to send in their resumes to get the free tickets. The club is then going to circulate those resumes to the corporate partners and to the companies of season ticket holders. And then, Bill, then the Nets are going to hold a career day on November 22nd at the Izod Center in East Rutherford. What do you think about that?
Well, let's take the high road, Tony. I mean, I think it's great, number one, given the state of the economy, that anything that you can do and a sports team can do to help, that's wonderful. You know, the sports teams, the entertainment industry has been doing, you know, surprisingly well in this wretched economy because, you know, this is where people go to escape. So that's fine, and I think that's really good. Of course, if you go to the Izod Center, I mean, the Nets are drawing absolutely nobody, you know.
For sure.
So, I mean, nobody.
Yeah, that's true.
They figure, well, maybe we can get unemployed people to come because You know,
nobody else is
doing?
Going, right? Well, that's one way to get people to come see a last place team. Maybe the L.A. Clippers need to try to do something like that as well.
It could be catching.
Let's hit a couple of quick hits in the time that we have left. First, the Tennessee Titans, they're undefeated, seem to be getting stronger. They're no fluke. But my question to you is this. Vince Young, the quarterback, sitting on the sidelines, has to be thinking, well, what can he be thinking when the team is doing so well without him? He was already a head case. He must really be going crazy now.
Well, maybe this will get him straight. You know, maybe you understand that, you know, one cog doesn't stop the show. And, you know, I think that he'll – you have not heard the last from Vince Young.
All right. MVP, who's your midseason NFL MVP? A lot of talk about Kurt Warner with the Cardinals. He's having a great year. Scorched San Francisco Monday, 328 yards through the year, no picks, three TDs. The guy is on fire.
I think that right now there'll be two candidates with both quarterbacks. I think that Kerry Collins has got to be, if Warner is A, I think that Kerry Collins with the Titans got to be A1.
All right, Major League Baseball. It's not Manny, Manny, Manny. It's money, money, money. Agent Scott Boras has said to the league owners, back that Brinks truck up if you want Manny to be on your team. They've already poo-pooed the Dodgers' measly $60 million offer. What about that?
If I were Manny, I'd keep my behind in Los Angeles. That's where, you know, the dreads are flying. The people love him. I'd stay in Los Angeles. And if I were Manny, I'd tell Boris, listen, man, peace of mind counts.
All right. College football, before we go. Alabama, Texas Tech, currently number 1 and 2 in the BCS poll. But the question is, will they stay there if either one of them stumbles, Bill Roden? You've got four teams with one loss right behind them, Florida, Texas, Oklahoma, and USC. And it seems that the SEC title game could be for all the marbles this year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying this just because you're in Los Angeles, but I think that USC is going to be in that BCS game. And frankly, I like Alabama. USC is strong to play an awful conference, but they're a very strong team. So I like Alabama and I like USC.
All right, people out here will certainly like to hear that. Here's my last
That's
one
why
for
I said
you.
It.
It is semi.
I know my bread is butter.
You're a smart guy. Semi-official. The Lakers and Celtics are headed for the NBA championship again. Do you believe that? The Celtics are 8-1. The Lakers are perfect 7-0. Who really can challenge them in 10 seconds?
Tony, I like them both. I think those are really two strong teams, man. I can't vote against that. I love Boston and the East. I love L.A. and the West.
You're a smart guy, Bill Roden. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. You're welcome, Tony. It's always a pleasure.
Bill Roden is a sports columnist with the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. He joined us from the studios of WGBH in Boston.
The Obama family is moving their home to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, picking out a puppy and looking for a new school for Sasha and Malia. Michelle Obama has reportedly looked at two private schools in the D.C. area. But journalist Stephanie Mensimer has a novel idea not tried since Amy Carter lived in the White House. How about sending the girls to a public school? She's here to tell us about the open letter she wrote to the president-elect. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
So the future First Lady has been looking at schools for Sasha, who's 7, and Malia, who's 10. So far, she's reportedly gone to visit two schools, both of them private schools. Now, we'll just cut to the chase here. In your open letter, you say the arrival of the Obama girls in a D.C. public school would send a powerful message to other nervous yuppie parents. Your kids will be okay here. Come join us. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the big problems with the D.C. public schools and probably public schools elsewhere is that the middle class has all but abandoned them. And all the political clout and the energy that comes with involved middle class parents has been dispersed and sent into private schools. And the public schools are really suffering for that. And I think that if the Obamas decided to send their kids to public school, that they not only would bring that energy with them to the school and the attention to the school, but they might attract some more middle class parents back into the system who have a really disproportionate effect and are a force for good for bringing the school's standards up and making sure they get the resources that they need. And those efforts affect all the kids, not just the children of those specific parents. So I was hoping there might be a little trickle-down effect with the Obama family coming here.
And there might be some overlap between your family and the Obama family in school district?
Yes, I confess there's a fair amount of self-interest at work here. The school that the White House is in the district for is Francis Stevens, I think it's called Educational Campus now, and it goes from pre-K to 8th grade. And my kids are actually in a neighborhood school that goes to 5th grade, and after 5th grade, they too would go to Francis. So it'll be a couple of years from now, but I was thinking, well, gosh, wouldn't it be great if the Obamas went there? Think what a great school it would be by the time my kids got there. And of course, you know, we all worry about these things down the road.
There have been, you know, kind of on a broader political level, there was a time when there was an incredible amount of support in the Black community for vouchers, basically parents saying, we just need to get our kids out of these schools. That has changed somewhat over time as people have looked at the issue more. But still, you have a situation where, as you mentioned, there's these schools that don't have a lot of, you know, middle class, upper middle class parents in, you know, sending their kids to the public schools, even if they live in the district. Do you think at this point, though, that the schools will change fast enough for your kid, for the Obama children, and for the children of families who may be less privileged than either of you?
Well, I think that the schools are changing quite a bit right now. We have a new school chancellor and a relatively new mayor who've made this their number one priority. And so there's a lot going on here. But I think what people don't realize is there are actually already some very good schools in the D.C. public school system. And certainly the Obamas would be going to those schools and not to the ones that are really struggling and failing. And the school that my son goes to is probably on the cusp. We live downtown, and our little school is starting to draw a lot more of the kids whose parents decided not to leave for the suburbs. They're people who like living in the city, and they want to stay here, but they can't afford private school, or they don't want to send their kids to private school. And so they're coming into the system, and I think already you're seeing a lot of the impact of that. So, you know, I don't think the Obamas would necessarily have to worry that their kids would suffer by going to public school, because they would send them to a school that's already there.
Do you think that this will help race relations? I mean, fundamentally, on some level, there are some people who've left the city saying, whether or not it's true, oh, I've got to leave the city just to get my kids into a good school system. Do you think it'll change race relations if the Obamas send their kids to a public school?
I hope so. Probably not. I think because when it comes to the schools, I think that it's really the segregation that you see is much more along economic lines, because the Black middle class has also left the public schools. So while the D.C. public schools are still predominantly Black, I think I looked at the numbers, I think only 5% of D.C. public school students are white. So I don't know that, you know, adding the Obamas to that mix would necessarily make a big difference. But at the same time, you know, they might draw some more white families back in because they're middle class, not necessarily because of the racial issue.
Okay. Stephanie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Mensimer writes for Mother Jones Magazine, and you can find her open letter to President-elect Obama by going to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. She joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How's it going?
I'm doing great. So we survived the election, and we keep on trucking. What are folks saying this week?
Well, as you can guess, we got several letters reacting to Senator Barack Obama's White House win. Here are a few responses we got on our website. Alicia Brown wrote, "Tonight, I thank my dad for never being home as a kid because he was always gone registering people to vote. White people have no idea what the kids of civil rights leaders feel right now."
Then Diana McClung chimed in on a web discussion about Senator Obama's racial identity to say this, "I don't care if the person I voted for is green with polka dots and three eyes. So long as they convince me that they have the better plan for our country, they have my vote."
Then we got a letter yesterday about the discussion we had about multiracial identities in America. Charles Johnson in Cary, North Carolina, gave us this perspective. At some point in talking about racial identity, when do we mention that all people, according to the latest research, we are all Africans, whether you call yourself European, Asian, etc. The research shows we all have a common African gene.
And finally, we got a few letters about a segment we did last week called Race and Privilege in an Age of Obama. Paul Gustman in Miami, Florida, wrote us this. Your guest infuriated me by first calling America a place of white supremacy and then saying that a dialogue was needed between the races. Maybe the gift of Barack Obama is that he avoids the accusatory code words that may feel cathartic to utter, but do nothing to further interracial understanding and acceptance.
And that's it for letters. Thanks for writing, and please keep your comments coming.
And here's how you can exercise your right to vote, your vote on what we're doing online, that is. Go to our program page at nprnewsandnotes.org and click on a segment, then click on the comments link and give us your thoughts.
And you can still send us your gripes and praises by logging on to npr.org and clicking on Contact Us. Be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.